Under the southern stars, I heal all of my scars. As cicadas sing, ain't it the sweetest dream? Winding kudzu vines untangle up my mind. Happy love, it is my home, sweet home. I've been adrift down most highways. I've been lost at sea. There's one thing this world can never take from me. No matter how far I go, no matter how deep the dark, I know I can always count on the southern star. Temporary tree where somebody told me so on and on. I've been adrift down most highways. I've been lost at sea. But there's one thing this world can never take from me. No matter how far I go, no matter how deep the dark, I know I can always count on the southern star.
Cobb is joining us here on the podcast today. We are going to talk a bit about his upcoming album, Southern Star, that's going to release. Well, actually, if you're listening to this podcast, it'll be out now. So
yeah.
Go check that out and purchase it, get a physical copy, stream it everywhere. It's been a couple of years since you've been on the show, bro.
I know, damn it. I feel like I'm not going to apologize because it's nothing
personal.
Apologize. But I remember when the last time we hung out, I had been writing with Adam Hood,
yep,
and Little Big Town guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had so much fun, and I was pretty loose. I was loosey-goosey that day. And
yeah, I remember that.
And we had, the three of us, me, you, and Mike, had considered maybe we should just do this, a check-in every so often thing.
Yeah.
And I'm just not – I mean, if you couldn't tell, just me trying to get my headphones for this – I am not organized at all, and I have, you know, two kids and constant. You know how it is. You're touring now, and it's hard to keep up with things.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that probably sounded like a lot better of an idea in the moment when we'd all been drinking beers.
I still mean it though. Is what's, you know, I would genuinely like to do that.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Well, maybe we'll do better this time. Maybe we'll have a quicker turnaround on the next one.
Yeah.
But shit, I guess we got it. That must mean we have a lot to talk about since the last time that we caught up. That was December of 2020. That was right around the time that Keep 'Em on Their Toes came out.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, man, I was gonna say, like, as far as like COVID records go, that one seemed to be really well received and really, you know, find a way to have like some
life.
some life, and yeah, exactly. That's a great way to put it. Some life and some success, despite the fact that you couldn't tour it for the most part, and you know, just with all the bullshit going on.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you had anything that you could expand a little bit on that.
Well, for that album, I would say that I agree with you. I would, if it had been any other album, I probably wouldn't have gone ahead and put that one out. But that album was the, you know, the common theme there. Like, as I think we talked about this on that last podcast, mm-hmm. but the common theme kept becoming more and more relevant throughout the whole year. Each song was like, fuck, this is exactly what's going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so the more that happened, and those songs, the more I was like, I have to put this out this year. And I think that's why it, you know, people listened to that album, even without any tour support or anything, was right. Because it was so relevant. And it was so, you know, it was already intentionally recorded to seem very intimate and just me and the songs. And, you know,
yeah,
man, I'm so proud of that album still.
Yeah. Yeah, you should be. That's a fantastic record. Definitely one of my favorites from that year.
Thanks, man.
When were you able to get back into touring? Did you get to maybe tour that album a little bit? Like, obviously this one's 3 years later, so you've been playing those songs, I'm sure, live. I haven't got the opportunity to see you live since then, but when did you get when did you hop back into it touring?
We, 2021, let's see. I think I started that year. Me and Kendall Marvel went out on a, like a, as you know, a duo, just acoustic songwriter type.
I think I remember tour.
And then later that year, me and Nikki Lane, we did a tour together. And, you know, that was so, it was a weird time to go back to tour. And I remember me and Nikki had many conversations about socially distanced shows. Mm-hmm. And, should we do this? Should we not do this? You know, is it going to be worth it? Is it going to make sense? Or we're putting people in danger. And, but we also needed to make some fucking money. And, and I wanted to play the songs live. So I guess I toured some of that album then. And then, last year I did the gospel tour, and then we did something, but I guess really this year really is the first year that we're playing, you know, those songs and new and old ones and
full band back to full swing, hitting the road, like
with full capacity crowds. Yeah.
It must feel good, man. It must feel good to be back doing that.
Dude, it really does. We played we played the Harvester in Rocky Mountain, Virginia this past week. And I played there maybe twice before, maybe three times. But for like both those other times, it was, you know, the first time I was there, nobody really knew who I was anyway. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have much of a crowd. And then the second time, it was half cap and COVID restrictions. And so this was the first time we sold it out, and the crowd was badass, man. Hell, it was so much fun.
Hell yeah, man. Good for you. That's awesome. Yeah. And then, I was going to say, that was kind of part of why I should have phrased it better when I asked that question, but you had the gospel album come out, and it kind of sandwiched in between. So it was like almost like the window of touring that 2020 album had almost like you had to go play the gospel songs, you know, like it was a tough little time frame for sure. So, and you've been on the road, you've been doing some dates with Luke Combs, those huge like stadium shows.
Yeah, it was
wild.
That was crazy.
You were up in my city. You were up where I went to college in Edmonton, Alberta. How was that?
Oh yeah.
I was like, I gotta squeeze that in there. I gotta get your impressions of Edmonton.
Well, Edmonton was cool. I will say on the Canadian shows, it's so expensive, you know, to take a full band, not just to Canada, but like anytime you cross a border, it just, you know, I was arrested like 10 years ago, and they don't deal kindly with reckless driving.
Yep.
And, And so, you know, hopefully this year it expires. But it's just kind of a headache to take bands. So,
oh, yeah.
So those come shows in Canada, it was just me and my guitar player, which already playing those size venues with, you know, with a, even a full band and nobody knows who you are for the most part. You know, it's 50,000, 60,000
yeah.
seat venues. And
wow.
Then just through our door, because we were the first of four on the main stage. And so just through for our set, it was 20,000 people through the door.
Damn.
And which here's a crazy
still a lot.
here's a crazy comparison is 20,000 people was the capacity for the crowds for those Stapleton shows that I did for those 3 years.
Right.
And so it was wild that 20,000 people looked like nobody in,
right.
you know, a 50,000 seater. And, but it was cool, man. Your hometown's cool.
Yeah.
I think we ate some Tim Hortons.
Oh, and, good. Yeah. the food's not that good, honestly.
Or is that your hometown, or is that just where you went to school at?
That's where I went to school. I grew up about an hour and a half in a really small town away from Edmonton. But I went to college there. I lived there for a few years after. And that's pretty much where I was living at the time before I moved down here, like came down here to Texas to start doing this. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, we had fun. We did good.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what also was crazy is, you know, well, I'll go back a little bit. So when I first met Luke Combs in 2014, and this was my daughter had just been born. I had stopped touring for those 2 years to just be around and write for other people. And I had a friend of mine who knew Luke, and Luke had just moved to town. He said, "Hey, man, I got this buddy of mine. He just moved to town. He's a singer. He's a big fan of yours. He just wants to hang out and have a beer and maybe ask you some questions." And it's like, he said, "Would you be into that?" I said, "Yeah, I don't know what I can tell him, but I can drink some beer with him for sure." And so we went over to at the time it was Broadway Brew House, is in Midtown, and we ate some jerk chicken and drank some beers. And he asked me some questions, and like I guess I was just focused on the jerk chicken and how good it was, and he was like he was focused on taking the world over, and and so he did. He took the world over. And but he remembered me, you know, taking the time to hang out with him. And because even at that time, I'd already been doing it for almost 10 years, you know.
Mm.
And he remembered that. He remembers the people who wouldn't take the time with him either.
Right.
But what's crazy is on those stadium tours, even that many people, you know, we did that run of Whiskey Myer shows. There's like five shows in between the 26 shows that we did with Combs. And man, I made more friends and sold more merch on those five Whiskey Myer shows than I did on 26 Luke Combs Stadium shows.
Wow. I feel like probably the Whiskey Myers crowd is definitely more, you know, more, I guess, connected to your music, or like they're probably, you probably have a lot more fans coming to those shows than who know you already.
Here's what I think, right?
Well,
perhaps just because of our history, I've known Whiskey for forever, and I wrote, you know, been grateful. I'm grateful they have written a bunch of songs that they've recorded.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I think more than anything, I think their demographic. They're more they discovered Whiskey Myers themselves, and so
right.
I think that
right.
demographic is more open to discovering music that they'd never heard before themselves than you know the commercial radio crowd. And this is nothing, I'm not talking any shit, but they're more the way they discover music is through the radio and someone else saying you should listen to this. And so I think that's the main difference.
Dude, that's absolutely true, because that Edmonton show, for example, I knew, oh God, man, like everybody and their fucking dog that I know went to that show because they're all big Luke Combs fans. He's huge up
there.
Right.
Yep.
But I think who was the other opener? It was you. It was it Laney Wilson?
Laney Wilson.
And was it Flatland Cavalry?
Flatland.
Okay, so it was Flatland. I told everybody that I knew was going to the show. I was like, don't you dare fucking show up at 10 o'clock to see Laney Wilson and Luke Combs. I was like, go early and see Brent and see Flatland. And they're like, well, I don't know that. I'm like, I don't give a fuck. Go see the openers.
Yeah. You know? Well, I tell you what, man, you just reminded me. They might have even brought you up. It might have been some of your friends, because when
I know exactly who it was. Yeah.
when I get off stage, I always just go out and hang out. You know,
you were wearing the Kippies and Cowboys shirt. I'm pretty sure.
I damn sure was.
Yep.
And this dude and his girlfriend and some other folks stopped me, and they were massive fans, man. They'd been listening for a long time, and they were like, whatever about Edmonton, but you need to come. You know, wherever they were talking about, and like they had a bar and everything picked out. I'm ready. This guy sent me a direct message.
Awesome. But that goes for any show, for anybody out there listening. It's like, go see the fucking openers, you know,
because
80 to 90% of the time I say, I mean, there's some times where it's not the case and the venue just books an opener, but chances are the headliner fucks with the opener and believes in the opener, you know?
What I was about to say, you know, fuck everybody else. But for me, I've never been a part of a tour that the opener didn't personally, that I didn't already personally know.
Right.
And I was personally asked and invited by whatever that opener is.
Exactly.
And so, yeah. Yeah, I can't understand that reasoning. But yeah, it's funny. Those kind of shows, man, you can see the wheels turning. Like, you can see, I can look out and I can see the dude. He's got his arms crossed and he's like, I don't know this guy. I don't know, you know, and he's just like super skeptical. And then halfway through the set, you can see the gears starting to work together and he's like, he's all right, I guess.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. And like you can see him loosen up and like be like his arms uncross. He's like, okay, he's cool, I guess.
Yeah, it's a fun thing. It's a fun thing to watch happen. And you know, sometimes that doesn't work out. Sometimes they're like, fuck this guy, like get him off the stage. You know, but you know,
that's pretty much my whole career.
Come on, you know, most of the time. Most fans, especially at smaller shows, I would say most fans are pretty, if they do show up early, they are pretty respectful and they do want to hear.
Sure.
They are open-minded, open to hearing something that they've never heard before.
For sure. I always thank the early arrivers for being there early.
And the other bonus to getting there early is you get to camp out in a good spot by the stage. You get to have a couple extra beers before everybody else does, you know.
Well, and you don't have to wait in such a long line for those
exactly.
beers.
You can go get merch for everybody else, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, but let's dig into the new album a little bit here. I want to play When Country Came Back to Town as the second song in the show. I don't know if you remember from the first time, but we'll play three of the songs from the new record.
Cool.
I want to dig into that song a little bit and play it second, just because I feel like there's a lot to talk about with that one.
Sure.
I remember you initially, like the first time I heard you play it, I believe it was on like, fuck man, I should have looked it up to like look at the date on the YouTube video, but I can remember exactly what
me
it was.
Me right here.
Yep.
At the basement.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
And what would that have been, like 2021?
2021.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, it was probably February of 22.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So about a year, a little while, a year and a half, I suppose. And I remember it, like, you know, kind of taking off on the little, you know, our little weirdo internet community that we have on Instagram and Twitter and shit, with people reposting it and everything and saying, wow, that's really, really, really cool song. At the time, I didn't know if it was one that you'd maybe ever... It was kind of one of those songs where it was like, I don't know if it'll maybe record that or if it'll just be like kind of a fun song that you kind of pull out at shows to...
Right.
Yeah, like I didn't know. It was like, oh, that's a really interesting song. Or, you know, hey, like you could add to that song endlessly from forever.
Right. it's the living song. Yeah.
Right. I want to I guess, you know what, maybe we'll rewind a little bit, and I'll ask you first. Just when did the wheels start to get in motion creatively for this record as a whole, and then maybe we can dive into that song specifically after we kind of covered the whole album.
Well, for the whole album, man, I'll say first, this was the first album that I did not have any of the songs wrote for this album before. Mm-hmm. Before knowing what the album would be. And the first one that I really wrote that started the whole, that, you know, started to unravel the common theme was Southern Star. Mm-hmm. And that happened, well, when Rowdy passed away, Jason Cope of the Steelwoods, who's like he was my older brother. When I was going out to LA, I would stay at his place, and he like, just taught me how to like do coin laundry and go grocery shopping and, you know, had me like diving into like really studying lyrics. And, you know, he was 8 years older than me, and he had been doing it for 8 years, 10 years longer than I had. And he just very much took me under his wing. And I think he was just happy to see like old country boys, you know, come out to LA and somebody he could relate with. And,
yeah.
But when he died in 2021, I just, you know, started like, I was on the way back home after a run, probably from that Nikki Lane tour. And when I was riding, I used to would call Rowdy on my rides back home, because, you know, now that you're in it and you're tour managing, and you're kind of up in that world, like sometimes there aren't as many people that can relate to, like, if you have anything to bitch about at all,
yeah,
you can't call somebody like one of your buddies back home, and because they'll be like, oh, you know, it must suck to be out there like touring.
Yeah. Oh, totally, man.
And so I would call Rad, and you know, we'd hash it out for an hour or two on the phone, and just you know, vent, and you just get shit off our chest and catch up. And and so I was on the drive back home, and so he used to live. I moved to Nashville first in 2008, and then he was already playing guitar with Jamie Johnson, and he didn't move to Nashville until probably like 2010 or so. And so I would go down and hang out with him 45 minutes south of Nashville, and we'd go to this bar. It was called the Southern Star, and it was like the fucking seediest, it was the seediest damn Dixie Mafia style. You could get anything. It was dark, man. But we'd go down there and we'd have some drinks, and then we'd go back to his, well, he was living in a little trailer on this lake, and he'd steal around on the steel guitar, and we'd drink and write songs and study songs and listen to songs till the sun came up. And I was missing Rowdy, and I was like, man, I wonder if that place is still there. And it just so happened on this trip back home, that I was right there at his old exit. And so I pulled off and went to the old Southern Star bar, and it's still there. It's not called the Southern Star. Yeah. It's not called the Southern Star anymore. It's called something else. And everybody that I knew that worked there and patrons of there are all dead now. And they have like a wall, a memorial wall in the back of the bar with everybody's old pictures on it. And anyway, I stopped there. I had a cheeseburger. I drank a couple beers and I smoked a cigarette. And then I started writing Southern Star that night when I got home. And that song led to every other song. It's like, oh man, I know what I have to do now.
Wow.
And I knew that I was going to call it Southern Star, because I just started reminiscing. I was thinking about, you know, the LA days when I was so homesick. Or now, even when I'm touring and I'm gone and homesick and feeling like I'm a shitty dad, or if I'm a shitty husband or a shitty person altogether, I can't tell sometimes. I will, you know, when I get lost out there, the thing was, if you ever get lost, look for the guidance of the Northern Star to lead you home. All right.
Right.
But I'm from the South. I'm from Georgia, so I look for the Southern Star. And
Gotcha.
and when I was in LA, Rowdy was one of those guiding lights. You know, he was a Southern Star for me. And on the flip side, I think about Rowd and how much influence he had on people like Leroy Powell, who was playing with the 357s, Shooter, Jamie, Dave, how much influence Rowdy's taste in music had on those people who were like these big move makers, you know, during the foundational era of independent country music where we are now.
Yeah.
And Rowdy had a lot to do with that, but not a lot of people know that. And so I was thinking, you know, even though in his life he never got to be known as like a world, you know, universal star, like a superstar, he, if nothing else, he's a Southern Star. And I super relate to that as well. You know, like the little joke I tell in a lot of my shows is, it's only taken me 20 years to get to the bottom. I'm just glad to be here. And so I feel that same way that, like, you know, that, like, if nothing else, if I were to die today or tomorrow, that even if I wasn't a superstar, I was at least a Southern Star. And so when all of that started to reveal itself as a common theme, then I knew, well, I have to record this album at Capricorn, and which is in Macon, Georgia's, an hour up the road from where I'm from. And, you know, everybody knows the history, you know. But but like Otis Redding and Little Richard are from Macon. They're from the same hometown. Also, you know, shining the light of that Southern Star on Southern music of the American South. And then you have Ray Charles, who's from an hour right down the road. And then you got James Brown, who's a couple hours up the road. And of course, the Allman Brothers. And I just knew I had to make this album there. And I had, luckily, I already had experience with I produced the Adam Hood album there. We did it at Capricorn, and you know, just Capricorn itself was such a light of a Southern Star, you know, and so that's how it all came together. It just all kind of like once I wrote Southern Star, the whole album revealed itself.
It just unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
That's so cool. That's a great lead into exactly when country came back to town, because basically that entire story that you just told is almost that is almost an expansion of that first verse of the song where you mentioned Rowdy and Shooter and Leroy Powell and Jamie Johnson.
Yeah. So, I knew the first day,
kind of that initial wave, you know, of
totally
like that foundation, like you said, that's a great way to put it, that foundation.
So I knew the first day that I stepped off the plane in LAX, and I landed in LA in 2005, and I met all those characters. I knew that someday I would write that song. I didn't know that it would be called When Country Came Back to Town, but I knew I would write about this whole movement. And it was an obvious movement even then, even before, you know, so this was a time when radio was still the king. The internet was happening. MySpace was brand new. So you still like had to lean on being heard through radio to get your music out there. And when Rowdy, you know, I watched it when I, so what's funny about When Country Came Back to Town that I've been reading, like even fans, and I appreciate, I know the intentions are well, but like some folks will say, man, that's a great list of artists, but the only name missing is your name. You should be in there. It was like, I know, that's why I'm writing it. I'm not just making this story up as a character. I was genuinely there when I was in the studio when
you were there. It's still coming from the horse's mouth. It's coming from the horse's mouth.
I was there. I'm including myself because I was there.
Right.
And I was actually in the studio, you know, when Jamie was recording You Can't Cash My Checks.
Yeah.
And
not to interrupt, but like, what are you supposed to say? Yeah. And me.
Yeah. And then, yeah. It's already like riding the line of a cheesy song. And so you can't name drop yourself if you write a whole damn name dropping song. And but I don't think folks realize that. I'm actually
Right.
recording a little video series right now to explain my relationship to these people that I'm naming in the song.
That's
Because
cool.
then on the other side, people who aren't aware of my career at all seem to think that I'm just trying to
Right.
associate myself, you know?
Ride
And
coattails. Yeah.
yeah, which is
Right.
fine, but it's just not true. But see, it wasn't until Rowdy died, though, really, that I was like, ah, all right, it's time. I got to write this song.
Yeah.
And so then I wrote When Country Came Back to Town.
Yeah. Well, it's a great song. It's a really cool song because, like you say, I mean, or like I said earlier, it's we start with that foundation and then you progress all the way through these past, what would you say, 15, 20, 15, almost 20 years type thing.
Almost 20 years, man. I mean, it's been, well, that Put the Old Back in Country album came out in
Right.
2005. And then
Yeah.
when I landed in LA, it was 2005, and they were just finishing, Shooter and them were just finishing Electric Rodeo. Right when I got off the plane, we went straight to Hollywood Sound, the studio right in the middle of Hollywood. And they were finishing up Electric Rodeo, and I met all those characters. And I would say in my time that that album and the Hank 3 Lovesick Broken Drifting album, those two albums like started this scene in our time. I mean, you obviously already had your Lucinda Williams and Chris Knight, and you had, you know, like those. That's it was a similar thing, but it was that had happened through the 90s, right? And then early mid 2000s for my time, those two albums is what started it. And I know that like Put the Old Back in Country led to Jamie Johnson hearing that album and wanted to record with Dave. And then it was pretty apparent when, like, you know, so like you remember Lost Highway Records? So that was like Hayes Carl was on that, and Ryan Bingham, and that was late 2010s, or would that be 2010s? What would you call it? 2008,
yeah,
and so yeah, and then Cody Canada, who is on Universal South, with damn, why can't I think of the name of the band?
With Ragweed,
Cross Canadian Ragweed,
yeah.
Right? And so Shooter and the 357s and Cross Canadian Ragweed were both Universal South. And when I came to town, that stuff was the cooler stuff. And you would go down to Broadway and like the people playing on those bars on Broadway, they wanted to be cool, like Cody Canada and them, you know, and they wanted to be cool, but they're also scared to be cool because that wasn't, you know, what was selling. And like you could see, it was so fucking apparent. Like they, you know, they were all straightening in their hair, but then at the same time, they were, you know, getting tattoos and shit and trying to look like Cross Canadian Ragweed.
Right.
And,
which is wild, because that's still, I feel like that's still on, I mean, it's probably more accepted now, might I say, on Broadway, or they're less shy about it. But it's like you walk into a bar. How many times? I remember I was in Nashville in March, early March, and I went out on Broadway the one night, and me and group were just walking. We were just bar hopping, like up and down or whatever. And it was like, I think we walked into three different bars, and somebody's covering Feathered Indians by Childers. I mean, I would love to see the statistics on how many times that song gets covered on Broadway per day. It's probably in like the 50s or 60s. Like, it's probably an insane number.
And the deal is, what's crazy as shit is like, there was no way that would happen, you know, back when I first moved to town. I mean, you had a few of those Lost Highway folks. But see, at that time also you had this, it was a transitional period where you had all these super old heads that had been, they, you know, like, I don't want to name names, but I'm just going to. Larry Willoughby was the vice president of Capitol Records at the time. He had been in that position for 20 fucking years, and he was about to retire. And every major company was that way. It was these dudes that had been there for fucking 20, 30, 40 years about to retire, they were glazed the fuck over. They were like checked out. And Luke Bryan took me into Capitol Records to Larry Willoughby's office and made him listen to my version of Bar Guitar and a Honky Tonk Crowd on that No Place Left to Leave album that Whiskey Myers wound up recording later. And Larry was just like not giving a damn, like just he was done. You know what I mean? He just didn't care. And so it was this weird transitional time where like, it, you know, 5 years, 4 to 5 years later, all of a sudden you did have new, fresh, younger people that were like, saw what was happening, you know? And now, you know, now you see where it's all led to. And
so as an outsider, like who wasn't there, it seems like there was maybe like three-ish, you know, three kind of main factors in this like kind of explosion of like all those old heads like retiring and getting booted out or whatever it may be. The internet starting to pop off and giving people new tools to, you know, get their music heard by people who did not listen to the radio or whatever it may be, even people who did. And then, like you say, like just this, those few like huge albums and all that influence coming from that LA group. It's funny how much LA played into what was going on in Nashville.
You know? It's always been that way though. Yeah. Like even if you, I mean, you go back to like the Birds.
It's funny how Nashville almost kind of fancies itself like a small LA now.
Well, now, especially.
Now.
But you know, we're still 15 years behind in Nashville. That's what's funny, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what the deal is with that. It's funny because the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, so it hits the east first and it hits the west last. But when it comes to art and what is hip, it seems to go the opposite way. What happens in the west it becomes popular in the west first, and then it makes its way to the east.
Right, and it's funny, like all those other artists that you'd kind of mentioned there too, like Bingham, Hayes Carl, Ragweed, they kind of all bubbled up through Texas and Oklahoma, and I mean, and all the, you guys are from, you know, the South, like Georgia and wherever else down there, but you're living out in L.A., like all of this shit was going on everywhere but Nashville, and then, like you say, you brought it all back.
Now it's all happening, and, you know, it's amazing, man. I know that like the songwriting, you know, as far as streaming goes, as a songwriter is such a double-edged sword, because as a songwriter, it sucks. You don't make any money because of the streaming, but as an independent country artist, you know, it affords me a fan base that wouldn't exist. Tyler Childers would not be fucking superstar if it wasn't for streaming and the internet and stuff. That's not saying Tyler Childers should be a fucking superstar, because he is a fucking superstar. Right. You know, same with just any independent person you can think. I can remember a newsletter coming out. Did you ever follow any of that Bob Lefsetz stuff? Like, in the early 2010s. It's like 2012, 2013, 2014. He was an old label executive, but he started putting out this independent newsletter for music business people. And I remember reading one time that was like, dear independent artists, you do not have to fuck with major labels anymore. And it was so hard to imagine even then. He's like, in the next 5 to 10 years, you can just take your music straight to the fans. And Hank 3 was talking about this shit in like the mid 2000s. And you can cut out the middleman altogether. And he was totally right, man. And we made it. We're there now.
Wow. Yeah. Is there any that you can think of, any particular records? I mean, in the song, you kind of mentioned High Top Mountain, but is there any, do you feel like that was maybe the one, or is there a couple right around that time that you want to say were like those, that next step after the foundation that was like, now this shit is starting to hit?
I have to go to the foundation first, because that's what I was most associated with.
Right.
But like, of course, the Shooter album, which led to the Jamie album, which then very obviously branched off into Whitey Morgan and Cody Jinks, because Jamie didn't put out any, he still hadn't put out any fucking new music. What a dick. No, I'm just kidding. Jamie's been one of my, man, that guy is something different, man. He saved my ass during this Combs tour. He loaned me his tour bus. Wow. When we had two that broke down and never charged me. He said, all this will cost you is a co-ride. I was like, okay, buddy, I will do that for free. But so those albums, you know, I remember when Dave first started coming to town and him saying, I really want to work with Jason Isbell. And I was like, I don't really know Jason Isbell. And they, you know, Southeastern, they recorded Southeastern, and that shit was definitely a foundational album. Yeah. And then that not High Top, but Metamodern. After they recorded that, Stapleton, who I had written with, he was another person that Dave was like, man, I'd love to make an album on Chris Stapleton. I was like, I write with him, but I don't know him that well. He wound up making, you know, Traveler with Chris. And of course, you know, that moment at the CMA Awards was a big deal, man. I mean, it was the first time that there was somebody that had always kept it real, but had been a part of the internal community of the industry. Like Chris, you know, he's writing these hits for other people, but he was also playing in the fucking, what's the bluegrass band he was in?
Steel Drivers.
And then what's the rock band? Johnson Brothers. Like, it was a person like that that actually finally had a just breakthrough.
Right, you know? Somebody from within was doing the cool shit.
Yep. And and so, you know, that happened. And then, you can connect all the dots. My song helps connect all the dots. But, like, I can remember in 2017, I had already made Shadow on Rainy Day. I had yet to be offered the Stapleton tours. I had written with Chris. I didn't know Morgan yet. And but Tyler opened that show at the Basement East in 2017. I had Miranda was a special guest. But the first time I ever even heard of Tyler Childers was that night. And he was opening for us. And he's opening acoustically. And it's funny because I didn't even realize this until the other week. There, you know that real popular video of him acoustically doing a cover of Time by Pink Floyd?
Pink Floyd, yeah.
That's my show.
No shit.
At the Basement East. If you look behind that Taylor guitar, that's my Taylor guitar sitting back there. and so, like, you know,
wild.
All these little things, man, and all these people who, like me, knew that, like, I just want to keep it real. And I know it's as commercial as what the fuck is on radio. And, you know, I just want to be heard. Like, there were just finally there was enough of us, and there was the internet and just all these little, you know, little victories that happened that, you know, now people see the value in it. And so there are like whole film crews that are going to sort out the next Tyler Childers or the next Coulter Walls. And they're going to these little hollers in Kentucky, and they're finding people with the fucking camera crew and with the story in the movie already fucking written, man.
Right.
And and this is not taking away from the people that are being discovered now.
Yeah.
They're fucking great. But the difference is they actually have people who know the value and that, you know what I mean?
This has been a real easy conversation because that was my next series of questions here that I was going to ask you was how did you experience that ripple effect of the growing popularity of like the Tylers, the Sturgills, the Isbells amongst like the mainstream artists? Because you hang out and you've been writing for a long time with a lot of mainstream artists, writing songs for other people. And, you know, you've been able to have probably a glimpse into their world quite a bit,
for sure.
probably more than a lot of independent artists. And so I was curious about that, like throughout all that time, how did you see that start to affect them?
Well, I don't know that it affected the artists so much as it, like, if we're talking about the commercial side of things, those artists, more so than it just affected the people around those artists. Like right. it affected when I moved to town. No way you would have any sort of major in support at all if you did some shit like any of the people named in When Country Came Back to Town. At all. You did not, it just didn't happen. Like, there was no money in it. It used to be laughed at. I had several label people that would be like, you don't want to be Americana. You know, I was like, I don't know. I kind of fucking do want to be Americana.
Yeah, I kind of do, actually.
That's where the fucking cool shit is. And and if nothing else for the actual artists creating, I do think that it hopefully it helped them like with their emotional and mental health a little bit, because for so long you had to just do, this is what you have to do in order to be played. And now you have these major players, artists that are like, oh, I can just write a real fucking song when I don't have to try to write, you know, the fucking the
right.
recipe of a radio hit.
Right, know? Right. Well, I think we've introed it enough. I'm going to go ahead and play that song, obviously, for everybody. We did a pretty good dive into it, so we'll play that, and
cool.
We'll catch everybody on the other side.
I was there when Shooter Jenny rewound the sound like a cassette. I watched Jamie Johnson cut You Can't Cash My Checks. Back then, Ratty Jason Cope was running Shine Sunset Divine, picking songs with Leroy Powell, making redneckisms rhyme. I guess now everyone knows Cousin Dave, that he's been around a while, proving simple truths in music. They just don't go out of style. It's hard to tell that when you're in it, sometimes a moment's too profound. But if I had to bet my money, that's when country came back to town. Right after that, I moved to Nashville. Most of Broadway stars wanted to be Cody Canada, Ryan Bingham, or Hayes Carr. Too cautious to commit, so they surrendered to the game. But nobody sang like Brandy Carlile, wrote like Nicky Lane. But you couldn't deny that it was lost, or how it would be found. But when Sturgill climbed high top mountain, country came back to town. Beyond the pickups and the back roads, you could almost hear it play, though it was softer than a whisper through the past. Some say it never left, some say that it got saved, some say like everything, it changes over time. Well, all I know for certain is I'm glad I was around when country vacuum leaving greater between commerce and art. Folks like Miranda Lambert kept the beat inside its heart. Right along with Chris and Morgan and Casey Musgraves too. What took the world so long to catch it, for us was nothing new. Out of time the torch was passed and the hatchet was laid down. Music Row had nearly burned out when country came back to town. Beyond the pickups and the back roads, you could almost hear it play. It was softer than a whisper through the past. Some say it never left, some say that it got saved, some say like everything, it changes over time. Well, all I know for certain is I'm glad I was around when country came back to town. Oh, when country came back to town. with a list a mile long. Names like Childers, Jinx, Price, and Whitey Hood, Shook, Cook, Cawthon, and Combs. Lord knows it's hard to name them all. Hell, right off the top of my head is Bell-Eated, Pat, and Moonpie, Turnpike, Coulter, and Crockett. Now I won't be stopping, no name dropping, till history books echo the sound of all the folks who settled in and drove country back to town.
So I was going to mention, like, we kind of skipped over this when we got diving into When Country Came Back to Town and the album, its origins, writing Southern Star. I just wanted to talk about the sound. So how did the sound of it develop? Because, I mean, I feel like it, I feel like it's really laid back and really groovy, like, the whole way through. And it kind of, knowing now that Southern Star was the first song written for it and the rest kind of unfolded for you, after you'd written that song, is that kind of, and it is a laid back shit, like, really nice groove through the whole song. It's just a really easy to listen to song, as is a lot of your music, might I add. You have a really great way of, with your delivery and everything, just the way you put things together is just really easy to listen to. But even in some of the jammier tracks, you know, like Devil Ain't Done or Oh No When, it's like, it's still laid back, you know. It's got a lot of keys on it. It's really groovy. I was just wondering how that all unfolded for you in your mind when you were writing the songs. Could you kind of hear that just when, if you were sitting down with the guitar just yourself, could you kind of hear that developing as you wrote that?
Absolutely. Yeah, man. One of my favorite things to do is arrangement. And so that, like, this is the first album that I self-produced.
Yeah.
Very cool. But luckily, the last couple of years, like the Hood album and Caleb Lee Hutchinson album, and maybe there's like one or two more in there. Wilder Blue and somebody else. I've become more comfortable with articulating what I'm hearing, you know, to a band. And so by the time I made my own album, I had a little experience under my belt. With that said, I've always known what I wanted a song to sound like. I just didn't always know how to articulate that to a band. And, right. You know, but if you go way back to even like Dirt Road in Georgia on that No Place Left to Leave album, from that first album me and Dave did together with Shooter and 357s in 06, it's real similar. And I just love that. I love that painting of, you know, where I'm from, the South, man, which is the home of fucking country soul. Like, I mean, you got Otis Redding, Little Richard, James Brown, Ray Charles, you know, all these people right from where I'm from. And even growing up, I grew up with all that music, real close to it. But for a long time, I don't know that I fully understood, like, how amazing that was. And how much it was who I am. And so that was the goal, especially on the song Southern Star. And the rest of the album was like, I'm making a Southern eclectic album. It's sometimes I rock, sometimes I roll, sometimes a little country, sometimes a little soul. It's all Southern though. And it always has been. And so what is that? You know, and to me, that is first the song. And you got to have an acoustic guitar. You got to have just a little bit of a backbeat, and you got to have a fucking organ. You got to have, you know, some keys and then a little pretty little guitar. And then really what drove the, so anytime we get a little too soul, the harmonica would bring it back country for me.
Yeah.
And I just want to ride that line of Southern soul music, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how it happened.
Beautiful. Well, I'm gonna, we got like 5 minutes left. I'll ask you, I don't know if you remember last time, I'll ask you some rapid fires at the end. I was gonna skip them, but we do have a little bit of time, so we'll wrap it up with that. All right, what's your favorite, when you're on the road, what is your favorite thing to do on an off day, if you guys got some time to chill out?
Oh man,
whatever.
you know, if we're in a nice place, I do like to get a little shroomy and go nice. Walk around on a nature. You know, I like to get out in the woods and, you know, I just like the woods. I like to grill and just do some old regular woodsy, shroomy country shit.
Hell yeah. That's awesome. What is, we'll stick with the road thing. What's your favorite snack along the way from the truck stop, from the gas station? What's your favorite? Yeah. What's your go-to?
Well, a lot of times I like boiled peanuts, but I'll boil my own peanuts before we hit the road. And because I don't like canned boiled peanuts, that's some bullshit. And so I'll boil up like 2 gallons worth of peanuts and then bring them on the road.
I'm yet to try the boiled peanuts.
Don't try them until you can try some of mine, because boiled peanuts, man, people can really screw them up.
I've seen them in the gas stations, but I haven't.
Don't do it. It
depends
Don't.
Where you are. Like, I've seen them down in the south in the gas stations, but I haven't.
Don't do it. They still ain't right. See, nowadays, back in the day, I'd say go ahead. But see, nowadays, all they do is they take this canned boiled peanuts. I won't name the name brand because I don't want them talking. Think I'm talking shit.
You're gonna get sued.
maybe, and there's a reason why that you'll discover later. But the canned peanuts, they just dump the can into the fucking hot pot, and they heat them up, and so it's shitty peanuts. And used to, they took a little more pride in their nuts.
Right.
And,
a little more pride in their nuts.
Yeah.
You know, I like the if you can get them from like a good gas station or even just like a small chain gas station and like a small like mom and pop gas station, you know, they're fresh. I like the like warm pecans.
Hell yeah,
the candied pecans, those are fucking good.
Yeah, they are.
That's good stuff. Okay, I'll ask you one about. Maybe the guys in the band over the year. What's the grossest thing that you've seen somebody eat? Like it's normal. Like they're just like, oh, you haven't tried this, and you know, like it's they think it's normal to eat, and you're like, what the fuck is going on?
I don't know. I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I don't think most things are gross. one time I talked a band member into eating a. You know, one of those, we might have talked about this last time, one of those pickled eggs and at a gas station. And I grew up, I knew they sucked.
Like the packaged ones?
No. Like, you know, you go into them old country gas stations, they got like a fucking jar.
Jar with the pickled eggs, yeah.
Yeah. And it was like pickled quail eggs. And I was like, man, you don't eat pickled eggs? I was fucking with him. I just acted like they were the best thing ever. And they're not. They're not good. But he had not ever had them. To me, they're not good. And
I don't hate them.
I mean, what? Hey, man.
The small bar where I grew up, it was like none of the bars had that shit, you know, around. But it was like this one little tiny bar. And every time we'd go there, it was like kind of – it was a ways from where the town that I grew up. You had to drive about 15 minutes to get to there. So, it'd like, once in a while, like, we'd be like, oh, like, if somebody's birthday or something, it's like, we're all going to go to this little tiny bar and we're going to drink it dry type shit. But they always had pickled eggs, homemade, by the way.
Yeah.
Not like some store-bought. Like, they're homemade with the onions and the red peppers and shit in there.
Yeah,
so they actually had some flavor. And I would, you know, like – you know, around 12:30, 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
Like I'm kind of want a little snack, and so I'd have 2 or 3 pickled eggs. It was real good.
Well, I'll say that I just knew that this person would not like them, and and it was, I guess, more than anything, his reaction was hilarious.
Did he get sick?
Oh yeah. Oh, he immediately he was purple. You know, he was not happy. He was not happy about it.
Oh shit, that's funny.
Yeah.
Oh man, we're at about an hour here, and I appreciate you taking an hour out of your day and having a little chat.
Oh,
tell
sure.
us about the new record. Thanks for breaking down that song. I know we probably spent more time on that than we maybe should have, but I feel like that's a really important story for people.
I agree, man. I appreciate y'all caring to want that story to be heard. You know, I don't ever want to sound arrogant or anything, but motherfuckers,
no,
I've been there. I've been there.
Yeah,
since the beginning. You know,
absolutely. No, I don't think you sounded arrogant at all. It's great. People are going to be very interested to hear. the expansion
yeah.
of that story from the song. And honestly, it was perfect because it, you know, it perfectly tied into, you know, the story about Rowdy and how kind of this album really came to be, honestly. So yeah, no, I appreciate your time, man. And thanks for hanging out again. And we'll hopefully get back to doing another one sooner than almost 3 years or whatever it's been.
So
we'll do better next time.
Thanks for all y'all do, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And everybody, if you're listening to this podcast, Southern Star is available everywhere now. Go check out, go grab a physical copy, obviously, on your, what is your website? Is it just BrentCobb.com? I usually have this pulled up, but.
BrentCobbMusic.com.
BrentCobbMusic.com. There you go. Album's obviously available everywhere on streaming platforms and all that good stuff. Look out for the video series that you were talking about. Kind of diving into some of these stories a little further. Those will be really interesting to hear.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, thanks again as always. And go grab a ticket for when you got any tours coming up, like fall tour to promote here right now?
Well, we're doing the Southern Star tour all the way through November. We'll be everywhere. And we're always touring perpetually.
Hell yeah. Good stuff. All right, man. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We are going to play, let's do a quick little intro for one of my favorite tracks on the album that I really wanted to get in here was Kick the Can. If you want to intro that one, I'll leave it to you and we will roll right into the song. And thanks again.
Yeah. Hey, this is Brent Cobb. You are listening to Hippies and Cowboys podcast. This is a new song off my new album, Southern Star. It is called Kick the Can, and it goes like this.
I was young, just a kid, lived true stories, never fear. Riverbank, Friday night, got to ride it, hold me tight. Skip the law, can't be found, ride around all over town. Hit the dirt, kick the can, mess around and start up a band. Time rolls on. It's the same old song. But I ain't no fool. Cut my path either way, no matter what they had to say. Might be right, could be wrong, even with my boots put on. Tried my best to make the scene, till I had a damn love for me. Time rolls on. It's the same. Sometimes I just can't hardly wait.